Welcome back. We'll begin the class with a mantra to the guru. You may know this one, this Bali Gana. Please join me if you know it. Translation of that mantra. Guru Brahma. Guru is the creator. Brahma is the creator. That from which this whole universe springs is called Brahma. That's the Guru. That reality in which all of this duality of subject and object, time, space, and causality, from which it all arises, is called Brahma. That reality in which this duality arises is the Guru. That's the real Guru. Guru Vishnu. This reality which has arisen is pervaded by something. That thing by which everything is pervaded is called Vishnu. That's the Guru. Everything comes from the Guru. Everything is pervaded by the Guru. Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Devo, Maheshwara. Maheshwara is Shiva. Shiva, the destroyer. Everything dissolves into him. That consciousness in which all duality arises, Brahma. That consciousness which pervades all of the duality, Vishnu. That consciousness into which all the duality disappears, Shiva, Maheshwara. Sakshat Parabrahma. That Guru who is Sakshat. The word Sakshat means direct and immediate. The Guru is not something outside of you. He's not something indirect. He's Sakshat. There's only one thing that's Sakshat, by the way. It's your own self. That Guru is Sakshat because he's your own self. Sakshat, that from which everything has come, by which everything is pervaded, into which everything merges, that reality which is direct and immediate, Sakshat, that is the Parabrahma. That is the supreme absolute reality. Tasmai, to that Gurave, to that Guru, not to the guy who's sitting in front of you with an orange robe, but to that Guru, Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. My prostrations to that supreme Brahman, the real Guru that exists in everybody as your own self, direct and immediate. You can see it for yourself. It's in your own consciousness that everything is arising. You are the Guru. It's your own self. Everything that arises abides in that. That's Vishnu. And when it disappears, where does it disappear? In me, Shiva. That consciousness which is Sakshat, direct and immediate. Why is it direct? Because we don't need our senses. If I needed my senses to know the guru or myself, that guru would be indirect. I would have to know it through some means of knowledge. But the self doesn't need anything to be known. It's called Svayam Jyoti, self-lit, self-revealed, self-evident. Nothing needs to make it known, because it's the light in which everything else becomes known. That's the real guru. To that guru, my own self. The real guru is the self of everyone. The guru is never away from us. You can never lose the guru. He's your own self. It's called the Paramarthika guru, the real guru. But there's a false guru, and that's the guy that sits in front of you and teaches you Vedanta. But it's not really the guru, unless you see that guy as yourself. When you see the guru as yourself, then you know who the guru really is. And it's that guru in the form of that body, mind, and senses that's sitting in front of you that says, Tattvamasi. Because the self doesn't speak to you. The guy that's sitting in front of you has to say, Tattvamasi. That's the guru. Without him teaching you that fact, you can never get out of this ignorance of I am this and this is mine. And once I am this and this is mine, then I'm out seeking for happiness, seeking for immortality, seeking for freedom. And I can never find it in my ignorance. I'm going to tell you a story. It's what the really, who the real, how the guru functions in Vedanta. You may have heard this story because it's a fairly well-known one, but it's always nice to hear anyway. There was once a guru, and he had 10 disciples. And there was a head disciple. I think I told this last year, yeah? For those who aren't here. And he said to the head disciple, I want you to take these 9 other disciples. They were in North India. They were in Rishikesh. And they said, I want you to go down to Madurai and go to the Manakshi temple. And in that temple, there's a beautiful devata, Manakshi Devi. And you go and have darshan in that temple. And then you come back. I'm making you in charge. You're the head guru, the head disciple, okay? So when you come back, I want you to report to me how was the darshan. And I'm making you in charge to make sure that these 9 other disciples are safe and they get back here in one piece. Can you do that? Yes, Guruji. Yes, Guruji. Always say yes to the guru. Yes, Guruji. So there they go. You and the 9 others. And you travel. In those days, they traveled by feet, no shoes, so it's slow. They finally got down to the temple. And they all go in. They have darshan. It's so beautiful. There's a certain, they're so happy that they accomplished this. Now the head monk says to the other 9, okay, we did what the guru said. Let's go back and report. So they start on their journey back, and on the way back, they come to a river. And at the bank of the river, there's a boatman. He's got a little boat, and he's sitting there, and the 10 monks, the head monk comes up, and the boatman says, where are you guys from? Oh, we come from the Himalayas. Our guru has told us to go down to the Manakshi temple for darshan. We had darshan, and now we're going back to report. We're so happy. And the boatman says, very happy for you. I hope you have a nice journey, and I wish you well. Namaste. Namaste. Then the head monk looks at the other 9 and says, can everybody swim? And everybody says, yes, we're expert swimmers. We can all swim. He says, great, I can swim too. Let's jump in the water. We're going to swim across to the other side. So they all jump in the water and they swim across and they get to the other side. They're getting ready to proceed, and the head monk says, "One second. I just want to make sure everybody got across okay. I'm going to make a count. I'll count and make sure everything's good." So the head monk goes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. What's it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh my God, the 10th monk is missing. He asks all the other monks, "You count." And every monk does the same thing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Oh my God. And they start crying. The head monk says, "Hold it. Everyone said we're expert swimmers. He must have made it. He's somewhere. Let's split up. You guys go this way. You guys go this way. We're going to find that 10th monk, because Guruji is not going to like this." And they split up. They're looking under the rocks. They're picking up the bushes. They go until they're exhausted. And they come back. "So, any sign of the 10th monk?" Nothing. The 10th monk is missing. And they begin to weep and wail and cry. They're sitting there crying. Remember that boatman that they met on the other side? He sees what's going on over there. He gets into his boat. He comes over to the other side. He goes to the head monk. "Hey, you guys were so happy a few minutes ago. You're now crying. What's the problem?" "You don't understand. I'm in big trouble. My guru sent the 10 of us for darshan, and now there's only 9. The 10th monk is missing, and we're distraught. We don't know what to do." So the boatman looks it around, and he does a little count. He says, "One second. You say you came 10? "Yes." "You say you're 9 now?" "Yes." He says, "Don't worry, I will produce the 10th man." The head monk looks at him and says, "What, when I go to heaven?" No. "I'm going to produce the head monk, the 10th monk, right here and right now." When the head monk heard this, he had a little, "Right here and right now? Okay. Go ahead, produce the 10th monk." He says, "Before I produce the 10th monk, I want you to do one little thing for me." "What's that?" "Just count one more time." So the head monk goes, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. "Where's the 10th man?" And the boatman looks at him and says, "You are the 10th. You are the 10th. Tattvamasi, you are that. That 10th man that you were looking for is you. This moment he said, 'You are the 10th, the 10th man was found." He goes, "Oh, I forgot to count myself. As soon as I forgot that, I was in ignorance and I began looking for the 10th man." No matter how hard they looked, no matter how much effort they made, they could never find the 10th man. The more they looked, the better the 10th man was hidden. It wasn't until someone said, "Stop. Stop the search. What you're looking for, you're already that. You are the 10th man." Without that teaching, in the ignorance that they all had, they began searching for what they wanted. But they were already the 10th man. That's the situation in Vedanta. We're already that. But because of my ignorance, I've taken myself to be this. And until I find a guru like that boatman, who knows the truth of the matter, and can point it out to me, and say, "You are that," then no matter how much I try to be happy, no matter how much I try to be free, no matter how much I try to be anything that I want, especially immortal, I'll never be able to find it by any effort that I make, because it's all a matter of a mistake, a misconception, ignorance. And the only way to get rid of that ignorance is by someone who knows the truth and knows how to point that truth out to me. Now, in the story, it wasn't very difficult when the boatman said to the monk, "You are the tenth." He got it immediately. He didn't have to do any pranayama. He didn't say, "Oh, let me raise my chakras out of my..." He says, "Well, hold on, I'm going to do some nadi yoga here for a little while." Nothing. The words, "You are the tenth," was all that was needed. He understood, and the tenth man was gotten, attained, found. It's called the attainment of the already attained. That has to be by knowledge. If it wasn't already attained, then you'd have to do it by some effort, by some activity. But if you're already that, no effort, no activity, all that's necessary is that your ignorance of the fact gets removed. That's the guru. The very word guru in Sanskrit, guru, gu means darkness, ignorance, and ru means light, the remover of darkness. That person who removes your ignorance is called the guru. He doesn't ask you to do anything. He wants you to understand a fact, to realize a fact that's already there. He points out that fact, and once you realize that fact, you realize, what I've been searching for, I am that. I've always been that. Even when I didn't know I was that, I was that. Without the guru, well, just like those 10 monks searching, 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 and never able to find it. That's why a guru is absolutely necessary. Now, I'm going to tell you two things in Vedanta, because that story is not exactly the true situation for people like us. Because we hear this teaching, "You are that," and it doesn't do anything for us. It doesn't seem to do much. I go about my business just like before. So why is that? And the reason is because we're not qualified to understand that teaching. So I want to talk about what are the qualifications for someone who wants to study Vedanta, who wants to understand Vedanta, who wants to make it their own experience, not some type of intellectual activity, not some type of memorized words that you could spit out, but something that is sakshat, direct and immediate in your own experience. Who's the qualified student? And who's the qualified guru? Because everybody is not the qualified guru, sorry to say. So let me tell you what the Upanishads say about who's the guru and who's the student. You know, yesterday I began and I realized that I told you that there were three major texts to study Vedanta, and I mentioned the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita, but I don't think I mentioned the third text. It's on the other. So the third text is called the Brahma Sutras. It's the most difficult of all the Vedantic texts. You can't study it by yourself. It's impossible. You need a guru to study the Brahma Sutras. The Gita is more accessible. The Upanishads also very difficult. So, let me just say a thing about the Brahma Sutras. I'm now talking about the qualifications necessary to understand the teaching, you are that. Three words, little words. You, three letters. Are, A-R-E, three letters. That, four letters. You are that. That's the whole Vedanta. If you understand that, adios. You're off. That's it. Nothing more to do, nothing more to learn, nothing more to practice. If you learn that, you are that. The Upanishad says, Brahma vid, Brahma bhavati. The knower of Brahman is Brahman. When you know that, you'll be that. Just like when the head monk knew he was the tenth man, he became the tenth man. He was always the tenth, but because of ignorance. When you know you're Brahman, you will be Brahman. You remember what I said Brahman was? Existence beyond time and space, consciousness bereft of all objects, and bliss, infinite bliss, not caused by anything. All the other blisses of sex, of food, of a beautiful sunrise, whatever causes you happiness, is a tiny atom of the infinite bliss of your own self. It's the bliss of non-duality. When nothing has to cause your happiness because it's your very nature. That self, that Brahman, which is Satchitananda. In order to realize that, we need a guru. The Upanishad says, Guru eva abhigachet, Kshatriya Brahmanishta. Guru eva. To a guru alone. Guru eva. To a guru alone, abhigachet, you must go. You must go. There's no other way. Without a guru, you'll be looking like the tenth man. And the more you look, the better this truth is hidden. Guru eva abhigachet, Kshatriya Brahmanishta. That's the qualifications of a guru. Kshatriya Brahmanishta. Let me translate. A Kshatriya is somebody who not only knows the Vedantic scriptures, but he knows the method of the Vedantic scriptures. There's a peculiar method in the scriptures. You see, this truth, this Parabrahma, cannot be described by any word. Yat vacho anavartante aprapya manasasaha. That from which all words return, having failed to reach, along with the mind. Whatever the mind thinks of, it's not that. Whatever words describe, it's not that. Words can't describe it. The mind can't conceive it. So how does the teacher teach this? All he has is words. The scripture is just made up of words. So what is the method? There has to be a method by which words are used in a very peculiar way. I'm going to discuss this method at some length during the course of these talks. But that guru has to know that method that's embedded in the scriptures themselves. The method of Vedanta. That's called the Kshatriya. The The guru must be a Shrotriya, well-versed in the method of the scriptures. How is it that the scriptures can convey something that no word and no concept can ever convey? That guru knows that method. That's called the Shrotriya. But that's not sufficient. He has to be a Brahmanishta. When I say he, please take it that she is included. He is just a convenient. It's the same self in all beings. So the guru can be a male, a female, it doesn't matter. So when that guru has to be a Brahmanishta. What's a Brahmanishta? Someone whose mind is firmly established, rooted, situated in that reality. He knows the scripture and the method of the scripture. He has to know that, but that's not sufficient. He has to have a mind. The guru that's teaching you has a mind. The real guru has no mind. The real guru is Brahman, the true self. But the one who's sitting in front of you has a mind. And that mind is rooted in Brahman. That's called the Brahmanishta. In the Gita it says, Atmani eva aramantaha. That person revels in the self alone. Atmani eva tushtaha. That person is satisfied in his self alone. Atmani eva stittaha. He's established in that reality. That's called the Brahmanishta. His mind, just like my mind, is established in this body and totally identified with it. That Brahmanishta, his mind, is established in that non-dual reality, that infinite bliss of his own self. That's the qualifications of a guru. If the guru is not like that, if he doesn't know the method of Vedanta, and his mind is not established in this truth, meaning that it's his own experience, he can't be the guru. Shankaracharya, has everybody heard of Shankaracharya? Yeah. Shankaracharya is considered the greatest of all the Advaita Vedantins that ever lived. He has the most extensive writings. He's the most important philosopher of Advaita Vedanta. And this text that I handed out, which is the 13th chapter, if you look at the cover, it says something, what does it say? Bhagavad Gita Bhashya? Yeah, Srimad Bhagavad Gita Bhashya of Sri Shankaracharya. So the word Bhashya means commentary. So Shankara's commentary on the Bhagavad Gita is in this book. He wrote a commentary on it. In the 13th chapter, I'm going to read it to you later, but I'll give you a preview. He says, Sarva Shastra Vidapi Asampradaya vid murkahaiva upekshyam. English. Even though a person be learned in all the scriptures, if he's memorized the whole Bhagavad Gita, 18 chapters, 700 shlokas, every word he knows, if a person has even memorized all of the scriptures, but he doesn't know the method of Vedanta, he should be ignored as though he were a murkaha. A murkaha is about one of the worst things you could be in Sanskrit. Murkaha means like idiot. It's a really negative, it's a strong word. And Shankara is saying, even those great pundits, those guys who think they're hot stuff, they've memorized the whole thing, they can quote all the verses, and even if that person knows all of that, if he doesn't know the method of Vedanta, the true tradition of Vedanta, The Sampradaya of Vedanta, Morkahaiva Upekshyam, he should be ignored as though he were a fool. That's how important this method is. That's Shankara's opinion about it. The guru has to know the Sampradaya, the method of Vedanta. And he must be established in that reality. His mind has to be established in that reality. I'm looking for my glasses.
Okay. Who carries their glasses like that?
The second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is called Samkhya Yoga. The highest teaching of the whole Gita starts right in the beginning. How many people, tell the truth now, has read the Bhagavad Gita? All 18 chapters? Yeah? Okay. Very good. Most people can't make through the first chapter. But anyway, the first chapter starts off, there's a war. You know, the Bhagavad Gita is in a much bigger book. The Bhagavad Gita is in the middle of a book called the Mahabharata. You've heard of the Mahabharata? The Mahabharata means the Great War. The Mahabharata is a book that has over now 100,000 verses. When it was first written, they say it had 25,000. And over the years, they kept adding more verses. It's now 100,000. Because it was stories that people would wander around India and tell the story of the Great War. But in the middle of this book of the Mahabharata, the Gita takes place. So the context is there's a war. And there's the Pandavas, there are five brothers, and the Kauravas. And the Kauravas cheated the Pandavas out of the kingdom. And it was totally illegal way that they did it. And now the Kauravas said they were going to give back the kingdom. But when time came up to give back the kingdom, the Kauravas said, nah, I don't think so. So the Pandavas said, well, what are we going to do? They went to Krishna. Krishna says, hey, they're not righteous. They went back on their word. They're adharmic. You must protect Dharma. You must fight a righteous war and get back what's rightfully yours. You must enter into the battle. So there it is. They're all lined up. The Pandavas with their hundreds of thousands of warriors and the Kauravas and the hundreds of thousands. And they come to this field called Kurukshetra. And the two armies are on both sides. And just before the battle is about to begin, Arjuna says, hey Krishna, you're my charioteer. Before we start this thing, could you please bring me into the middle of the battlefield? I want to take a look what's going on. So they go into the middle, and Arjuna looks across, and he sees on the other side his teachers, his relatives, his grandsires, all the people, Bhima, Drona, the great warriors that taught him archery, that taught him everything. And he looked at them and he started to tremble. And he threw down his arrow and he looks at Krishna and says, you know, Krishna, if I have to kill all of these people to win the kingdom, let them have it. I'll be drinking their blood. I don't want it. I don't need it. Let them have it. How could we be happy if to get the kingdom we have to kill these respected people? I won't fight. I'd rather take up the life of a monk and live on alms. That's what he tells Krishna. That takes you up to the second chapter, the 11th sloka. And then the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita begins. The Gita has nothing to do with a war. The Gita has nothing to do with Arjuna's problem of having to kill his relatives. Arjuna thought, I am this, and those are mine. I am Arjuna, and they are my relatives, and my teachers, and those respected noble ones. And I am going to kill them, or they are going to kill me. And therefore, I'm suffering. I'm grieving. That grief is called shoka in Sanskrit. He was grieving. Arjuna was grieving. He was grieving because I am going to kill them or they are going to kill me. And in either case, it's not good. That's 2:10. And then Krishna turns to Arjuna and says, Asochan anvasochas tvam pragnam vadamsche bhashase nagatasu nagatam sumche anasochanti pandita. Hey Arjuna, you grieve for those who should not be grieved for. The wise neither grieve, shoka, for the living or the dead. That's the beginning of the teaching of the Bhagavad Gita. The wise neither grieve for the living or the dead. So, the wise neither grieve. We're all grieving. Not only Arjuna. We all grieve. If we live long enough, our loved ones will die. If we don't live long enough, we'll die before our loved ones. Either way, not a good situation. We're grieving. And the reason we're grieving is because we're deluded. In Sanskrit, delusion, the word is moha. Moha comes from the root in Sanskrit for moha is muj. To mix up, to be deluded, and mixing up two separate things is called moha. Do you remember yesterday I was saying, I am the self, the subject. This body, mind, and senses is the object. But I'm taking myself and I've mixed it up with the not-self and I say, I am this. And I am this and this is mine. That was the ignorance of Arjuna. I am a warrior and those are my relatives and teachers. And I'm grieving. Moha and shoka. That ignorance that Arjuna had about himself, that moha, that delusion, confusion about himself, was causing the grief. So the very beginning of the Bhagavad Gita is don't grieve, because when you know the truth, you won't grieve for anybody, because you'll see there's only the self. Nobody was ever born, nobody ever dies. Only the people who think that we're born and dying, they grieve. But for the wise man who has no moha, he knows the true nature of reality, he grieves no more. That's the beginning of the teaching. And then he begins, there never was a time when I was not, when you were not, nor these warriors, nor will there be a time when we will cease to be. The self in everyone is unborn, unchanging, imperishable. That's the very beginning of the second chapter. Right off the bat, he teaches him the highest teaching. The Bhagavad Gita teaching ends in the 18th chapter, the 66th sloka, which says, Sarva Dharma Parityaja Mam Ekam Sharanam Vraja. You guys repeat this every day at the satsang. You know that? I heard it at the end of the satsang. It's a different tune you sing it to, but. Masucha, don't grieve. I will release you from all sin. Serva papedya, all papa, aham vimoksha yishami. I will free you from that. If you do what? Serva dharma parityaja. You give up all other dharmas. You give up all not self. If you do that, Arjuna, serva dharma parityaga. Pari means completely. Tyaga, abandon. If you completely abandon all dharmas, mam ekam sharanam, and take refuge in oneness with me, you become one with me. If you do that, I will free you from all sin, the sin of birth, death, old age, disease, suffering, happiness and sorrow. That's all sin. In the Gita, that's what Papa really means. I will free you from all of that. If you give up all identification with this not-self and take refuge in me, in oneness with me, ma makam, me one, oneness with me, then you'll be free. That's the end of the teaching. There's no higher teaching than that. So at the end of the second chapter, after Krishna has taught him this, the very highest truth, right in the second chapter, it's called Samkhya. There's 72 shlokas in the second chapter. In the 54th shloka, 53rd shloka, Arjuna has a question. He says, the second chapter is called Samkhya. Samkhya means complete and total knowledge. That's the meaning of Samkhya. Complete and total knowledge. So the second chapter is called Samkhya Yoga, the yoga of complete and total knowledge. In the 53rd shloka, Arjuna, having heard this teaching about who the wise man is and how he doesn't grieve anymore and he realizes the self which is beyond time and space, which is Satchitananda, he turns to Krishna and he says, Stitta Prajna Ka Bhasha, what is the description of someone who is established in this Stitta Prajna, established in wisdom? Ka Bhasha, what is his description? How does he walk? How does he sit? How does he talk? That's the question. The one who has wisdom, how does he sit?
With a very straight back.
If you like this, you're not a stiff back. How does he talk?
Very slow.
And how does he walk?
Very aware of everything.
Krishna doesn't answer any of those questions. He doesn't answer how he walks, how he talks, how he sits. Because a wise man doesn't walk, talk, or sit. A wise man is that absolute reality. That's the true nature. But from the point of view of the guru, the guy who's sitting in front of you, that knows the truth, who has a mind, I'll just briefly read to you some of this description of who the guru is. I told you, the basic thing is, he knows the scripture, the method of Vedanta, it's called Shrotriya, and he is established in that Brahmanishta, established in that absolute reality. So when he asks him this question, in 254, Sri Bhagavan Uvacha, the Supreme Lord said, when one wholly discards all the desires of the heart and becomes exclusively content in the self alone, then one is called a sage of stable wisdom. When he's gotten rid of all the desires in his mind, heart means mind, and he's satisfied, atmani eva atmana tushtaha, when he's content in his self alone, when he doesn't need anything outside to make him more full, more complete, that the bliss of his own self is sufficient to give him the satisfaction he's been looking for. Atmani eva atmana tushtaha. He has no desire for anything outside. Stitta pragna uchite. He is said to be someone who is firmly established in that wisdom. The silent sage is said to have stable wisdom when suffering no longer perturbs his mind, when he ceases to cling to pleasure, and he's rid of all attachment, fear, and hatred. A wise man is not afraid of anything. He's attained the state of fearlessness. He needs nothing outside to make himself more full, more complete, more content, more happy. And when he intuits that supreme reality, I jumped. And when he's rid of all attachment, fear, and wrath, his wisdom is stable, stitta pragna. When he clings to neither good or evil, he's beyond good and evil. For him, dharma means nothing. Adharma means nothing. I am beyond dharma and adharma. I am the one reality. That dharma and adharma doesn't affect at all. Then his wisdom is stable. He neither seeks dharma, nor does he shun adharma. Whatever happens is perfectly fine with him. When he wholly withdraws all the senses from their objects, like a tortoise, its limbs from all sides, then his wisdom is stable. Yesterday I told you, when the mind is out, it's jumping from one thing to the other. Let's go to lunch, gotta do my laundry, what's in the bank account, stock market's not good, Donald Trump said this. This is going on. That's, the senses are out. But when the wise man has withdrawn those senses and buried them in his own self like a tortoise, in order to protect itself, withdraws all of its limbs. The wise man withdraws his senses to get the protection of abiding in his own self. Because when you're in yourself, nothing can hurt you. Nothing can harm you. Nothing can scare you. Nothing can bother you. Because there's nothing other than you. I'm not going to read the rest of it. It goes to the end of the chapter. It's very beautiful. That's the guru, the one who has a body. The real guru, Guru Brahma, Guru Vishnu, Guru Deva Maheshwara, Guru Sakshat, Parabrahma, the Supreme Absolute, that's the guru. But the guru who's like this, who knows the scripture and has a mind that's established in that, that's the apparent guru. That's the guru in the realm of duality. That's the guru in the realm of ignorance. In fact, that guru is really an ignorant person. The guru who sees you and understands your questions and can remove your doubts, the guru has a mind that's established in that truth, is an ignorant person. The real wise man has no mind. As long as you have a mind, you will suffer. Even if it's a mind that's content, even if it's a mind that's described at the end of this second chapter, it's still in duality. And as long as there's duality, the perfect peace of non-duality doesn't obtain. But relatively speaking, he's different than other people. He doesn't desire things outside of himself. He's content with whatever comes. He's not filled with desires. He's not filled with aversions, raga dvesha, likes and dislikes. That's, once I take myself to be this, then I need that to be happy. And I need to avoid that to be so I'm not unhappy. But the person who abides in the self, he needs nothing to be happy. And he needs to avoid nothing that might cause him unhappiness. Okay, that's the guru. Now we're going to talk about the qualities. If you can find somebody like that, by the way, you'll be very fortunate. There's not too many people that have those qualities. So when you go to a guru, so-called guru, you have to examine them very closely. And if you see they're just like you, filled with desires, they want your money, they want you to build an ashram for them, they want that, run fast, get out of there. If they want anything from you, the guru wants nothing from you. He sees you as himself, and he loves you as yourself. And that's why he teaches you. Not because you can give him anything. He needs nothing from you. He's happy to see you come. He's just as happy to see you go. It's up to you. There's two places where the qualifications of the guru, of the student, is delineated. There's many places in the Gita all throughout, there's descriptions of who the real student is. But there's two very important places. And one is in the Brahma Sutras, in the very beginning, the very first sutra. Does anyone know what a sutra is? What is a sutra?
Very condensed and short expression of a fact.
Perfect. A sutra is a very short little verse. It's kind of like an algebraic formula. You can hardly even make sense out of it. It might be two or three words, and that's called the sutra. They did this because in order to memorize 555 sutras, they had to be very short. It was called, how do you pronounce that? Mnemonic device. A way to memorize. The students of Vedanta would try to memorize these sutras, so they were very short. But because they were so short, they were almost incomprehensible. And you had to sit at the feet of a teacher who can teach you the meanings of these sutras. So the very first sutra begins like this. Atato Brahma Jignasa. Four words. Atato means after. Atato, after. Ataha, because. After, because. An inquiry into Brahman. Brahma Jignasa. Jignasa means inquiry. Brahma is that absolute non-dual reality. After, because, an inquiry into Brahman. So what the heck does that mean? It's not English. After, because. So Shankaracharya wrote a commentary on the Brahma Sutras. And so he begins with the first word, after. What does after mean? He says that after means after getting all of the qualifications necessary to understand this teaching, after that, and then he lists what those qualities are. There are four qualities. So that's pretty simple, just four qualities, except one, the second quality, I'm sorry, the third quality has six parts. So it's a little more complicated. And then the fourth. I'm going to tell you what he said, that after getting these qualities, atato, ataha, because, the reason of because is because when one knows Brahman, he attains the highest goal of human life. That's the because. After getting those qualities, because when you know Brahman, you'll attain the highest, you should inquire into Brahman. If you don't have these qualities, you can inquire into Brahman, but you'll never get to know it directly. It won't be your experience. The best you'll get is an intellectual appreciation, but you'll never get to know it in your own experience. So let me just briefly list what he said those qualities are. The first one is called Nitya Anitya Viveka, which means if you want to study Vedanta, you have to at least be able to have the capacity to understand that if I want something everlasting, nitya, eternal, it's never going to become about by any effort on my part. Whatever I do, I'm limited. Whatever I do will only produce a limited result. It will never produce an eternal result. Every result has a beginning in time and it must end in time. So you come to realize no matter what I do, I can never become eternal. Whatever effort I make, I can't become immortal. That's the beginning of realizing that no effort on my part can ever bring me what I really want, because I want to be forever, nitya. And whatever I do, the result will be anitya. That minimum of discrimination, that no effort on my part, whatever I get in this world, whatever I desire, if I finally get that thing, it won't really satisfy me. It'll come in time, and then you know what'll happen?
Go in time.
It will go in time. Whatever has a beginning must have an end. If I get something, I'll lose it. And even if I can keep it all my life, when I drop dead, that money, they'll go to the kids. Sorry to say. So I can't take any of it. None of it will be eternal. And I want nitya. So now, the second one. Once a person has realized this, then he develops the second qualification, which is called vairagya. Have you heard of vairagya? Vairagya. Vai without, raga, passion. Dispassion is vairagya. And Shankara defines that as iha motra boga viraktaha iti vairagya. Dispassion means having no desire to enjoy anything in this world. Yuck. Not even a good meal. Well then, okay, how about if I desire some enjoyment in the other world? When I get to heaven, when I get to Brahmaloka, when I get to Devaloka, I'll be able to enjoy there, yes? He has no desire for any pleasure in this world. And if there's any pleasure in any other world, he has no interest in that either. That's called vairagya. That's real. Some people feel, oh, this world is just temporary, but the other world, after I die, that heavenly world, maybe I can enjoy that. But the true Vedantin has no desire for any pleasure in this world. And if there is any other world, if you believe that there's another world, I have no desire for that either. That's called vairagya. Nitya niti viveka, vairagya. Those are the first two. As long as the mind is desiring to enjoy the objects, it will be extrovert. It can never understand the truth about the inner self. That dispassion, the seeing the defect in the object, the defect is that it has a beginning and an end, that it comes and it goes, and that it can never be nitya, eternal, and therefore I'm not interested in it. I want something that never ends. I want a happiness that never ends. I want a happiness that's infinite, unending. That's what I want. And I know that none of these things, none of these objects, could ever bring me that. With that attitude, I have a dispassion towards those things. That's called vairagya. The third qualification is divided into six parts. Shama, Dhamma, Titiksha, Uparati, Samadhana, and Shraddha. Shama means the student of Vedanta has to control his senses. The senses that are roving anywhere, looking to enjoy the world. The senses are what goes out. Once the senses are out and I see a nice thing, my mind is immediately follows the senses and the mind develops a desire. So the senses have to be brought under control. That's called shama. Then dhamma, the mind that was following the senses has to be brought under control. No longer wandering here and there, wanting this, avoiding this, planning for that. All of that, giving up all of that is called dhamma. Controlling the mind, getting a tight grip on it, not letting it go where it wants to go. Shama dhamma. The next one is, a student of Vedanta has to have titiksha. Titiksha means putting up with the inevitable pinpricks in life. The inevitable things that we can't do. You miss the bus? Ah, I missed the bus. What up? Hey. Oh, that person said that. We all know people like this, yeah? They can't put up with anything. The slightest thing goes wrong, they're finished. The capacity to endure the inevitable pinpricks of life is called titiksha. That mind that's controlled, that doesn't get upset merely because something went not according to how you wanted it to go. These are all qualities, by the way, that we have to make an effort to try to cultivate. It's something that you catch yourself and then you go, oh, that's not titiksha. That's not really that important. Let it go. Let it go. Titiksha. Uparati. Shama, Dhamma, Uparati. Okay. Titiksha, Uparati. I think it doesn't matter. Uparati means, so now the senses are not going out. The mind is not wandering everywhere. You're putting up with the pairs of opposites, heat and cold, happiness and sorrow. They're coming and going, but you're enduring them all, titiksha. And then uparati. Uparati means not only not letting the senses go out, but uparati means the mind and the senses turning in. We must turn in. That uparati is necessary to understand this teaching. Once the mind has become calm, dispassionate, realizing that none of these efforts are going to do anything for me, my senses that have been running wild have been brought under control. My mind that have been thinking of a million things that are going to make me happy or unhappy has been brought under control. And now the mind is uparati, withdrawn, turning back. That's called uparati. The mind has to become introvert. And then the last one in this is called Shraddha. The word?
Samadhana.
Samadhana. You put it in the wrong order there, you're confusing me. Samadhana. The last is Shraddha, is correct. Samadhana means equanimity of mind. That once the mind, when it's out, the mind has no equanimity. You want to buy that house? How much does it cost? The landlord said this. I'll offer you this. No, we're going to lose the house. When the mind is out, there's no samadhana because everything is changing every moment. There's no place to find any stability outside. But when that mind is uparati, turned towards that inner light, then the mind becomes samadhana. Equanimity of mind is an absolute requirement for a person who wants to not only study Vedanta, but actually realize the truth of it. Don't get discouraged. Nobody has these. These are ideals. These are ideals. Equanimity of mind. And the last one is a very important one. Shraddha, which means in Sanskrit, in English, they translate it by the word faith. A Vedantin has to have faith. What is this? Christianity? What kind of faith? I said you don't have to have faith. Faith here doesn't mean what it means in Judeo-Christian Abrahamic religion. Faith there means blind faith. You have to believe it because the Bible says it. You have to believe it because some prophet or some son of God said it. You have to have faith because there's no evidence. You'll only know the truth of it when you die. So until you die, you must just believe it. You don't know. That's theological faith. But here the word faith means this. If I were to tell anyone here, before you guys came in, I put a bag of money on the other side of that wall. Big bag of money. And if you go out there, you can have that money. So you look at me, you go, why would he lie about that? He might be telling the truth. And if he's telling the truth, I should check it out. So what you do is, okay, I have temporary faith in what you're talking about. And you get up, you go, and you look, and you see the money. You come back in, you go, hey, my faith was justified. You verified the truth of it. You didn't have to die. Right now you got up and you saw there's the money there. That type of faith, not a faith that you live and die with, but a faith that you can verify here and now in this life is called Shraddha. Suppose you went out there and there was no bag of money. You come back in and you know what you tell me? You're a liar. You're a fool. There's nothing there. My faith in you was not justified because I followed your thing and I couldn't verify what you were saying. This teaching is like that. It's only the open-mindedness to say, what is this guy talking about? What is the scripture saying? Is there any truth to it? The faith of, I'm willing to listen with an open mind, with no preconceptions, with no prejudices, and let me see what this teaching is. But if it's not in accordance with my experience, if I can't verify the truth of it myself here and now, then I'm not going to accept it. That's called shraddha. That amount of faith you have to have. Because in our ignorance, we don't know that we're that. It was like the tenth man, when the boatman said, I'm going to produce the tenth man right here and now. He kind of had faith in that guy. He seemed that he had conviction. And there was no reason for him to lie to him. So he said, okay, produce him. That's the meaning of shraddha. Not theological shraddha.
So more trust.
Yes, but not a blind trust that you're not going to verify. I'll only trust you this much. But if I see that anything you're saying is not in accordance with my understanding, my experience, then that trust is finished. That's the trust that's required. Shama Dhamma Titiksha Uparati Samadana Shraddha. And then the last and maybe the most important qualification of a student of Vedanta is called Mamukshutva. Mamukshutva is a burning desire for liberation. A burning desire to be free. It's not like, yeah, I want to be free, but I also want to do a lot of other things. I'm going to Italy. I heard the food was great. And I want to, of course, oh, I'm going to go to the Bali. They're having the yoga fest there. We meet all the yogis. And this desire has to be so intense. The way they describe it is that like a man or a woman whose hair is on fire and all they want is water. They have no time to discuss the weather, politics. I need water. That desire, that one-pointed desire, like your hair is on fire and you're looking for water, that's the desire for moksha. It has to be a burning desire. It has to consume you. I want that freedom. That's what I desire. You want money? Go ahead. You want a girlfriend? Go ahead. You want whatever you want? Go ahead. I want moksha, and I want it more than anything. Like a person who's being held under the water. All they can think about. Has anybody ever been held under the water?
No.
It's a pretty... you have to get that breath. That's all you're thinking. I got to come up for that breath. Nothing else. There's no time to discuss the weather. That's mumukshutva. If a person has that desire, no matter what, I'm going to get this moksha. No matter what, I'm going to find it somehow, some way. When a person has that quality, they say, now, don't believe me on this because I'm just repeating now. They say when the desire is that strong, the guru appears. The teacher will show up when you're ready for it. And when you desire it more than anything else, it's called a spiritual law, maryada. When the student is ready, the guru will appear. Until then, no matter what, he won't find the right guru. But when the person has all of these qualities, right up to mamukshutva, that burning desire for this, more than anything else, then the teacher, that guru, who's established in that truth, and who knows how to teach this truth to you, Kshotriya Brahmanishta, when they come together, like the boatman and the tenth man, nothing more is needed. That student has all the qualifications. And when he hears this teaching, when that teacher looks him in the eye, deep in the eye, and says, "You are that," that student can understand those three words in a way that's just like you see me now. As directly as you see me now, you see yourself, "I am that." That person who has those qualifications. I think, let's take a break. Yeah? So, this class ends at 6? Mm-hmm. Let's take a 10-minute break. So, it's now 4:15. We'll come back at 4:05.